For me, I was faced with mortality really for the first time in many years. I'd been living like I was invincible. I was going to live forever. And I was convinced something was terribly wrong with me. Maybe I had an incurable disease. But if I died, what would my life have meant? What would go in my tombstone?
Welcome to Leadership Conversations with Nikki Gumbel. It's been a while. It's Shayla here. In today's special one-off episode, we hear from Charity Water founders Scott and Victoria Harrison, a husband and wife team who have challenged and transformed the way the nonprofit sector thinks about engaging with donors. So far, Charity Water has helped over 15 million people gain access to clean water, work which has saved countless lives and given dignity and hope to countless more. In this interview, Victoria and Scott share their personal stories and stories from their work in the field as they strive to make water poverty a thing of the past. They also unpack some of the key lessons they've learned along the way around transparency, trust, and leadership. Now, some of the stories that Scott and Victoria share are heartbreaking, and one in particular involves a young girl taking her own life. We wanted to let you know up front so that you can prepare emotionally for that moment to come. That's around the 38-minute mark. I hope you find this interview as moving, insightful, and encouraging as I did. Here's Nikki.
Scott and Victoria, first of all, thank you so much for joining us. I've had the privilege, I think, of interviewing you before, Scott, but without Victoria. How did you two meet?
We met in 2006. Scott had just returned from 2 years living overseas in Africa. He was just getting finished with his time on a traveling hospital ship called the Mercy Ship, and he wanted to start charity. He started Charity Water about a month before I met him. I was working in advertising in New York City out of college. I had spent about a year working in marketing advertising, and our stories are similar in some ways because I was really disillusioned with my career, and that's kind of what also pushed Scott into this work. I loved the creative side of advertising, but I hated marketing things I didn't believe in. And so one day I was talking to a next door neighbor of mine who was nice enough to listen to my complaining about how I wanted to change careers, but didn't really know what I wanted to do. I wanted to solve big problems in the world. And he said, I have a friend named Scott who had just gotten back from living for 2 years in Africa. And he used to be a miserable nightclub promoter before that. And now he started a charity. Did you know that there's people around the world who don't have clean water? That's what he's working on. And I was 24 at the time. And I said, I've never heard of the water crisis. And 2 weeks later, I showed up at the first Charity Water event, outdoor event in New York City. And that's how we met. I volunteered for Scott's very, very new nonprofit.
And Nikki, she offered to volunteer as a designer after that. And I said, sure, come by the office. And then she turned up at this loft in New York City, you know, expecting an office. It was a kind of decrepit apartment, and I was sleeping on the floor at the time in the closet. So I don't think it was quite the professional start that she was hoping for, but.
And was it love at first sight for both of you?
For me, yes. For Scott, it took him about a year to
come to my senses,
to figure out that I was, that I wasn't really going anywhere, and that that he had some feelings for me too.
So the love at first sight was when you first met him, or even just when you heard about what he was doing?
Honestly, it was when I first met him. And I mean, when people say I don't believe in love at first sight, I really am not one of those people. So okay. I looked at Scott and I had this feeling of familiarity, like this was some old relative from the past or somebody that I had known in another life or something like that.
I should point out we're not related.
Well, go on, Scott.
Technically, we are. I mean, I don't
know. Now
we're related.
So, Scott, it took you a year.
It took me a year. I mean, in the beginning, I was so tunnel vision focused on trying to create a nonprofit out of nothing. And I was a club promoter with a dubious track record. I started Charity Water when I was $30,000 in debt because my nightclub promoter partner had never decided to file taxes when I was on the hospital ship. So it was 90-100 hour weeks in the beginning. I wasn't dating anyone. I mean, I was just trying to keep the thing alive.
And then after a year, you saw the light?
Well, one night I walked into the office around midnight and said, of course, Vic was working, and said, hey, have you ever thought of us? And then, as I remembered, she said, yes, I have.
I've actually cried lots of tears into my pillow now that you mention it.
And then and then the rest was history. So
but did you get married very soon after that?
We were engaged for, we dated for 6 months and, before you proposed. And then we were engaged for about a year. I think we figured out, slow. I was a little bit of a hot mess. I was raised very differently than Scott, honestly. And I think the love at first sight thing was more of a, more of an unhealthy thing for me than healthy. And I think I had some strange attachment issues, as one would when they're brought up in less than a nurturing environment. And Scott actually was, he was raised by really loving, nurturing parents. And I think he was just like, I don't even know you. Why should I feel any feelings for you at all? I mean, like, I need to get to know you first. So I would say now that we've done a lot of work in our, many, many years of marriage. Yeah. I think his was a much healthier, slower response to his. Yeah.
And how long have you been married now?
13 years.
13 yeah. years. And your children are what age?
6 and 8.
And so all that time you've worked together as well?
No, about 10 years. The first 10 years, Vic was the creative director and really helped build a brand. We think of Charity Water very much as a brand similar to Apple or Nike or Virgin. And the creative design, the aesthetics, the innovation, so much of that was led by her and the team that she eventually built. So it was a decade, and then she kind of dropped the bike and took some time off as our kids were young.
Yes.
And now is actually taking everything she learned, I guess, in the first 10 years of Charity Water and then watching me over the last 6 years, 10 through 16, she is now coaching nonprofits on how to be better storytellers, how to market, how to get people to care about their mission, their vision, and trying to help them grow. So
you're not working for Charity Water anymore?
No, not for the last 6 years. Yeah,
oh, wow.
But I do feel very connected and close to everything going on, just because, I'm not only I remain a student of Charity Water's work, taking the knowledge that Charity Water is continuing to develop and all the data that we've gathered about what works, what doesn't work, and then teaching that to startup nonprofits.
Okay, so I know you've told your story 1,000 times. But just for, in case anyone listening to this doesn't know.
Yeah. My mom became an invalid when I was 4 years old. There was a carbon monoxide gas leak, which almost killed everyone in our family, but irreparably damaged her immune system. So she was disabled for my whole life. I was an only child, really brought up in a faithful Christian home.
What impact do you think that sort of caring side, you had to kind of care for your mother? I don't want to be the psychotherapist, but
I'm happy for that.
the impact of that on what you're doing now. I mean, you obviously had a compassionate heart very young. You had to at 4.
I did. And if you'd asked me what I was going to be when I grew up, it would have been doctor, so that I could cure mom and cure other sick people like her.
Yeah. So that heart was there, although you went into the sort of nightclub, a totally different world, but deep down you had that desire to make a difference.
I think so. But it also drove me to maybe the lack of joy growing up, the rules, in some ways, I don't think it was always the healthiest form of religion or spirituality. I think that did, some of that led me to become a prodigal and to go rogue for 10 years. And in some ways, it's such a cliche story, Nikki, like to New York City, go drink, have sex, do drugs for 10 years, and then kind of wake up in the proverbial pigsty and say, what a mess I've made of my life.
Yeah.
I didn't find what I was looking for.
Did you have anything like that, Victoria, in your own life? Did you have any sort of like rebellious
You know,
I did you not have the faith growing up? Did you have your parents have a faith or not?
No. So I grew up in communist Russia, and we had no faith to speak of. And it was a really kind of dark, sad place to grow up. Outwardly, there were food lines. My parents stood in line for milk and cheese. Wow. But inside our family, we looked nice on the outside, but there was no emotional awareness and there was no spirituality. So everything was pretty surface level. Like, as long as you look good and you have great manners and you dress well and you know about art and culture, which was very big in the Russian world. My parents would take me to the museum every weekend. But in my, you know, we have very different types of just kind of lack and dysfunction in our families. And I think most people have a little bit of some of this stuff. And I can look at Scott looks at my life, probably thinks a lot, it probably would have been way more fun to grow up in a family that actually didn't have a sick mom. And I look at his life, I'm like, I wish I grew up in a family where parents who went through hard things exemplified, which his parents did, you know, how to deal with hardship through reading the Bible and having faith in their relationship with Jesus, which his mom was that proverbial or that like
underlined Bible.
With like the dog-eared Bible with every color highlighter, you know. Yeah. So I think in a way he saw examples of how to deal with really hard things, but in as healthy of a way as possible, which his mom, I do think, did, and his dad.
Were you in Moscow? Where were you in Russia?
I grew up in St. Petersburg.
Okay. So beautiful, a beautiful city, amazing museums, amazing history too, that of the seat of the siege and World War II, that and the history of that suffering people.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and Nikki, Vic's parents had her at 17. She was an only child. And then she moved to Brooklyn in New York City when she was 8 or 9, right?
9 years
old, not speaking a word of English.
Okay.
And then having to really parent her parents. You know, she learned English in a year and they never really did. So she would, you know, fill out forms at the DMV and would kind of be the interpreter for the family.
Yeah. But it's so interesting, isn't it? Because you've both had tough backgrounds in a way that has prepared you for what you're doing now. And the nightclub scene, that was like 10 years wild living. But you, Victoria, did you have that similar or short time?
Oh, yeah. My first experiences at a nightclub was when my dad drove me to a nightclub with a fake ID that he kind of thought it was cool that I had, and dropped me off at a club called Limelight when I was 16 and
like
underage
midnight.
And said, go have fun. So my dad was a hippie. My dad and my mom kind of grew up, I mean, they were hippie artists and just kind of let me run wild, which I definitely did. And at that time in my life, I thought I was really proud of that. I thought how cool my parents are. All these other teenagers, their parents make them stay home and come home by a curfew. I could stay out as late as I want. Now that I'm 40 and I have my own kids, I think that is incredibly irresponsible parenting. And I don't understand what my parents were thinking. But yeah, I did. I definitely ran around New York City. Probably went to a lot of clubs that he was actually at that same night, but never met him. Yeah, because they were pretty crowded.
Nikki, when I asked Vic's father for her hand in marriage, he said, why are you asking me?
Go ask her.
So the wildlife, 10 years of that, but enough for you to see just however much money you had, enough, however much sex, however much and many drugs, alcohol, watches and all the rest. It didn't really satisfy.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And there was never enough. There was never enough. And someone always had more. It was this insatiable desire for more status, a better watch, a better car, a better high, a better place to be seen with famous people. And every marker of success, you know, that was collected, there were so many more out there. And, you know, I was fortunate to have a turning point at 28 years old. You know, it really started with some health issues. Half my body went numb one day. I remember my friends were saying, no wonder. Yeah, dude, you're doing lines of cocaine. You know, you go to bed at 1 p.m. No wonder you're having health issues. But I think for me, I was faced with mortality really for the first time in many years. I'd been living like I was invincible. I was going to live forever. And I was convinced something was terribly wrong with me. Maybe I had a brain tumor. Maybe I had an incurable disease. And if I died, what would my life have meant? What would go in my tombstone? You know, did I still believe in heaven and hell? If I did, the once saved, always saved, didn't feel like I was ready to fall back on that because of the way that I lived for 10 years. So it really led to a longing for maybe home, you know, to use the prodigal son story.
Yeah.
And to rediscover faith, to rediscover morality and spirituality in a new way as a 28-year-old adult on my own. And, you know, that was a little rocky. I remember going to a bunch of churches in New York City, and they were in the basement of fluorescent lit cafeterias, and the worship music was terrible. I was trying to kind of find my way back, and there was a push-pull for a period of months before I eventually had this opportunity to go to West Africa, join a group of Christian doctors.
Did your faith come back through the Mercy Ship experience, or had it already come back and that's why you went on Mercy Ships?
I don't think there was one moment. I think it was a process over about a year. And that process started before I got on the ship, and then it continued while I was with these amazing, you know, Christian humanitarians.
Yeah. And Victor, what about you? How did your faith
start?
Really,
for me, it was liking Scott, and he went to church, so I was ready to do anything that meant spending time with him outside of work. And he kept inviting me to church. When I first started coming over his apartment, and we were working on Charity Water, it was myself, and another woman named Lainey, who was kind of our third musketeer in the beginning. And the three of us would work late, and him and Lainey would, you know, talk about, okay, tomorrow we're going to go to church, or tomorrow's Monday, we're going to fast. And I just thought this was the strangest, weirdest bunch. Like, what is wrong with these people? They're young. Why aren't they going out partying? You know, why are they talking about go to church? I mean, I literally was so ignorant. I thought, gosh, only old people go to church.
Yeah.
You know, and in my culture, really, that's what it was.
It was certainly Overground Church in Leningrad was very.
Yes.
The Orthodox Church back in communist times was to only old people, wasn't it?
Absolutely. You would never see a group of young college kids in an Orthodox church in communist Russia. I'll tell you that. It was all old ladies lighting candles for the dead. And so after a few attempts, after I rejected him a few times, he invited me again. He was persistent. And I said, okay, I'll come. And he took me to the all black gospel church called Brooklyn Tabernacle.
Oh, yeah.
Where the floor would shake and all these old ladies would speak in tongues and pray over me and put their hands on me. And I was like, this place is weird and bizarre. But I also definitely would leave there crying and felt the spirit. And you know, my faith grew slowly too. It was definitely this kind of combination of kind of how a teenager would inherit their faith from their parents. I felt like I didn't really choose it on my own. I inherited it through Scott just by wanting to be around him. But then slowly, you know, began to develop my own belief in Jesus and in the story of the gospel. Yeah.
Mm. Amazing. So 10 years wildlife, then re-encountering some kind of beginning to re-explore your faith and deciding you wanted to go and do the opposite to what you had been doing. So, and then you applied to all those charities. They all rejected you because you confessed to your drug past and your your consumption of alcohol. And eventually you had to pay $500 a month to go and work for Mercy Ships.
That's right. That's right.
But you went as a photojournalist and took some amazing pictures when you were on that ship.
So, you know, Mercy Ships is a floating hospital. For about 25 years, they had operated a cruise liner that had been gutted and converted. And it was a very simple idea. Let's bring the best doctors in the world on their vacation time from 40 plus countries. And let's sail up and down the African coast. Let's pull into port and let's help as many people as we can for free. And you know, my third day in the mission, I write about this in the book. You know, I remember we had 1,500 available surgery slots to offer. And this is cleft lips and tumors and fleshy disease and leprosy. Yeah. And I remember turning up at 5:30 in the morning outside a soccer stadium, that the kind of decrepit, broken down soccer stadium that the government had given us. And as we approached the soccer stadium with this convoy of doctors and nurses in their hospital scrubs, eager to see who we might be able to help, there were more than 5,000 people standing in the parking lot. And that next day, after we were through the triage, we sent 3,500 sick people home with no hospital appointment. And Nikki, some of these people had walked for more than a month. They'd walked from neighboring countries with their children, just hoping that a doctor would be able to help them. And, you know, that really moved me. I mean, the magnitude of the need, you know, here I was selling $25 cocktails and $1,000 bottles of champagne, you know, to rich people in New York City. And 5,000 sick people didn't even have access to a doctor. And if they did, they wouldn't have been able to afford the procedure.
Yeah. The doctor could have done the procedure. And like, you know, there's certain things that are incurable, but these are things that had they had access to a doctor, the blind could have seen, they could have had their tumors removed and they could have been healed.
Yeah. I mean, Nikki, I remember a story, a woman named Marguerite, and she had gone blind with cataracts around 20 years old. And, you know, this is exposure to the equatorial sun, no kind of UV protection, actually quite common. And she couldn't see a thing. And if you looked at her eyes, you would see these massive cloudy cataracts. I mean, you could not see, you know, her eyes. And, I remember documenting her surgery and it took 20 minutes. Yeah. And I remember thinking, I could do this. Yeah. He just took a scalpel, you know, he slit it, stuck in some tweezers.
$10.
Negligible, a few dollars. Yeah. And a very simple procedure. And, you know, he put in the new lens and he sewed her up. And I remember being there the next day when they removed the eye patch and she was in this little room by the dock. Her sister was there. She had had children that she'd never seen. And when they removed the patch, you know, she shrieked with joy. She tackled me. She tackled the nurse that had removed the bandage. She tackled her sister, hugging, jumping, screaming for joy. You know, and again, this is just something we had taken for granted. You know, I didn't know 20-year-olds with cataracts. Everybody has access to that surgery.
But I bet you felt more joy in that moment than in all the drugs and the alcohol and all the other stuff.
Yeah.
More of just the joy of being able to see that.
Yeah, I remember meeting a woman who was 58 years old in a village and she had a cleft lip. And for her entire life, food and water had spilled out of her face every time she tried to eat or drink. And she needed a $200 surgery that took about 40 minutes. And we convinced her to come on the ship and get her face and her dignity and her life back 58 years too late, but, you know, still before at the end of her life. So that was, it was an amazing place. I mean, it was, I wasn't missing the clubs at all.
No, I mean, but in all that, what you saw, because, I mean, there are so many needs in the world. I mean, there are all these blind people who could be healed. You know, probably 90% of them could be healed for a $10 operation. But you saw something that you realized was one of, if not the greatest need, but one of the greatest needs in the world today, which was you saw people without clean water.
Yeah, I did. So the second year, I went into the rural villages. And, you know, just like Vic said, I'd never seen a human being drink dirty water. This is not a going concern for people in New York City. We're not thinking about the global poor's access to the sanitation, hygiene, and water. But again, for me, I viscerally saw children drinking from swamps, drinking brown, green, viscous, diseased water. In one case, I saw a child drink from a swamp and then she would just throw up. And then she would drink more of this bad water. And then she would just continue this kind of, you know, cycle of drinking and vomit the water in real time actually making her sick. And you know, you or I would look at this water and say, we wouldn't give this to our dog.
Yeah,
we're not sure we would give this water to livestock. It's so dirty. And it's the only access that the people there had. Half the country was drinking from swamps and dirty rivers. And then half the disease in the country, I learned, was because people didn't have the most basic need for health met. They didn't have access to clean water. So I really found my way to water through the eyes of these doctors. And this kind of after the fact problems we were treating, but if they just had the basic need met, there would not need to be 5,000 people sick with things growing on their face, standing outside a stadium waiting to be turned away.
So many of the root issue was lack of clean water.
Correct.
Did you call it Charity Water straight away?
I did. I didn't have any better ideas. It's a charity that helps people get water.
And you got around the table and came up with some amazing ideas. Victoria, because I think you designed the original website, didn't you?
I did, and many more after. But yeah, yes, all of the first 10 years was my team and myself and learning along the way.
And behind that was an interesting take on charities, because I think you'd offered to help the ships, hadn't you, to be there kind of to transform the way that they raise money and all that. And they was like, oh, thanks so much, but no thanks. Whereas what you saw was that because it's a charity, it's even more important. If you're selling toothpaste, it doesn't matter as much as if you're saving people's lives. You need to have a good website. You know, whatever you would do for a secular job, you need to do 10 times that for a cause as important as this.
Yeah, we kind of intuitively made a lot of good decisions. And now that I teach other nonprofits, I realize how rare it was to see a founder like Scott and the way his brain worked. And one of the things we knew right away from the very beginning was the importance of providing an amazing experience for the donor.
Yeah.
An experience that was different than they'd had with almost every other nonprofit, starting with the 100% model. I mean, we kind of said, okay, let's counter every objection that donors have, that our friends and peers and our generation has, for why they don't trust and they don't give. And it was because they don't know where the money is going, because the charity doesn't really seem like they care about their small donation, because they're not sure the impact the charity is making, right? All of these things. They don't know who the founder is, or if the founder is, you know, crooked or corrupt or telling the truth. So all of this lack of transparency, all these things, we kind of just said, okay, how do we create an experience that would in every way possible bust all of these objections that people have to giving? And then, and I think what I see now that we did that was so counterintuitive is a lot of charities that say, I want to get really big, I want to scale. They say, well, what is this the most scalable kind of an experience that we can provide? And when they have ideas of delighting their donor in specific ways, they often will throw those out saying, well, that can't be scaled. I can't ever scale that. So we should never even try to do these things. And the way we approached it, which was counterintuitive, is we said, how do we provide the best possible experience? Forget about whether it can scale or not, but how do we just like provide the best experience for a small amount of kind of the true fans that we had in the very beginning? And a lot of it was manual at first. We would plot GPS coordinates of every well manually on Google Earth, and it took hours, right? Mm-hmm. And so many of these things, you know, Scott took a GPS device to Uganda to document where the first six wells that we'd built were located. And if you look at that, I'm like, well, that's not scalable. We'll never be able to fly to every well and stand in front of it and take a photo with a GPS device. But, you know, I think
and that specifically, we've now scaled to 111,000 water projects in 29 countries.
Yeah.
Each one of them on Google Maps.
Every single one. Yep.
And now there's a sensor starting to be put in on all of our wells retroactively. We're retrofitting many water projects with a sensor that's also going to show you, the donor, how many gallons are being pumped every single day, which times of day is water being pumped the most. which is really cool data to look at. So yeah, we said, okay, how do we provide the most amazing experience? And then how, which parts of it can we scale? Which parts of the magic can we figure out how to scale? And we've done that ever since. I think that's kind of the magic of Charity Water, is find the most unique experiences, develop them, and then figure out which parts of it you can scale.
But one of the most radical things that you did was to have two charities, almost like two accounts. Yeah. One if you want to fund central services, and the other one if you want 100% of your money to go to the cause. And I think you have 110 people funding the core costs, and then 1 million people funding the cause, or something.
You've
probably
right.
got more than that now.
131. So not
131
that many more.
Funding the core, and probably more than the million. How many?
Millions of people around the world have, you know,
I do. And so that was a really amazing thing, because it means that, because everyone, you know, if you sponsor a child, you think, well, how much of this money actually goes to the child? How much of it goes to whatever? But there was a transparency about it. 100% is going to the cause. And yes, we do need money for administration and all these things, but we're raising that in a different way from people who really get this. Now, Victoria, is that something you're teaching other charities to do? Is that something that other charities, a model that they're following?
You know, we've talked about this a lot and thought about it a lot. It is a really hard model to sustain. And I believe it takes a really dynamic founder, honestly, to keep all of those 100 relationships going. And there have been many, many years or moments or months where the two accounts didn't balance, right? So whether we have too much money in the water account and not enough money to pay our staff salaries. I think that more and more, it's an amazing model. It's often been considered counterproductive by other nonprofits, because people have said, I mean, you're setting a really unrealistic expectation for the rest of us. Now your donors who've gotten used to Charity Water's model, now they want us to do the same thing. They want us to have two separate bank accounts, and we can't. This is not how, you know, and so we've been critiqued, believe it or not, for that model. It's worked really well for Charity Water. I think the bigger thing, though, is if you're just transparent and tell people where the money is going, and you say 22% of your donation is going to go to operating costs, I think it's just the transparency that really matters.
So it was the transparency more than the model itself that is reproducible.
That's right, Nikki. I mean, I think donors are open to myriad value propositions. They just want to know where their money's going. What are they paying for? You know, you'd said, or my money's going to, who knows, right?
Yeah.
And look, I think that the 100% model worked for us. You know, it's allowed us now to raise over $700 million. Many donors are telling us the reason they're giving is because they know where all their money's going. I've heard time and time again, even from people saying this is the first charitable gift they've made in their life because they believe in that model. Yeah. So it's right for us. It's right for many others. There are probably 20 100% model organizations that we know now that are growing, that are thriving. In some ways, it's twice as much work because you do have to convince a small group of donors that overhead is needed. Yeah. And but in some ways, once you convince them of that, then you've got an investor for life. Yeah. So those 100 families don't cycle off very often. They stay with us. They actually grow their giving as we grow our impact. And then this community, you know, in the other bank account.
Those 100, it's an amazing vision, actually, because what you're saying to them is your 100. Your money is in enabling the million to give.
Right.
So
building the movement.
They can feel, because it's all, people want all their money to go because they want to feel good that everything they're doing is going to help the people. But actually, the ones who are giving to fund your core costs can feel doubly good because they're enabling the others to be able to feel good about giving all of their money to the project. So in fact, everybody should feel good about what they're doing. And I know you're sort of operating on Jesus's principle that it's more blessed to give than to receive. What you've discovered in your life is it's more blessed to give than to receive. There's a huge joy in it. So there'll be joy for those 110 families, or 131 families. But then also, as well as that model, you had the birthday party was a genius idea. Just say how that came about and how that's worked.
That's funny. We don't talk about it so much anymore, but it was a very simple idea where, hey, you're about to have a birthday. You don't need a tie or a wallet or a handbag. We have enough stuff. And yet, one
out of 10. You modeled it yourself the first time.
I did, yeah. I was 31 at the time. So this is 15 years ago, 16 years ago. I just said, look, I have enough stuff. Human beings don't even have clean water. Instead of getting me anything, donate $31. Well, actually, $32 for my 32nd birthday. Or if you were turning 16, 16 pounds or 16 euros. And we had this movement of people around the world that donated their birthdays to clean water, to charity water. And they raised over $100 million getting their friends and their family involved. And it went beyond birthdays, and people would run marathons or sell lemonade, you know, on their blocks. We've had mountain climbers. We've had people cross the Atlantic. So it was really this movement of fundraisers. But the birthday was a nice idea. Give up your birthday for clean water. Ask for your age in your local currency. And 100% of that money will go to help people get clean water. And then we will send the photos and the GPS coordinates and the proof of exactly where the money went, so that you know where your birthday funds went and all your friends and family. And that was really responsible for, you know, a lot of the growth, Nikki, early on, you know, charity water.
There was one seven-year-old, wasn't there? Was there a seven-year-old who pledged to raise more and then didn't make it and then became a...
Yeah. She was nine.
Nine-year-old.
Girl Beckwith. She tried to raise $300 and she fell a little short. And then she was killed in a terrible car crash after her birthday. And the story of her donated birthday for charity water spread around the world, and 60,000 complete strangers wound up donating $1.4 million.
Wow. What a legacy she had, that little girl. I mean, amazing.
Yeah, we got to take her, Vic and I got to take her mom and her grandparents on the 1 year anniversary of her death to Ethiopia, to go village to village to village, to meet so many of the thousands of children that that Rachel had given life to. So it was a pretty
amazing legacy of that little girl. What is it? 6 million? How many people have you brought clean water to now?
We've helped 15 million people.
But 15 million.
770 million people out there. So we've done 1/50th of the work that needs to be done to make sure everybody has access to clean water.
2% is a lot of people, but I mean, that is when you think, but I mean, what you do is tell the stories, the individuals. And that's what's so powerful. The story you tell of the, again, I don't want to just have tragic stories one after another, but the 13-year-old girl who fell over and broke the jar.
Yeah.
I found that really moving.
Yeah, there was a story of a 13-year-old girl who would walk 8 hours for water. And I think sometimes it sounds like hyperbole. Yeah, you know, are people really walking 8 hours for water?
They
truly are. And in this village, she had this clay pot that she would strap to her back, and she would leave early in the morning, and she would get to the water source. She would have to wait because the yield was so low and there were other people in front of her. And one day after this 8-hour walk, before she reaches her home, she stumbles and she falls and her pot smashes, and all the water that she spent a day collecting spills out onto the ground. And she was in such despair that she took a rope and she tied it around her neck and she climbed a tree and she jumped, and the village elders found her body hanging with a noose around her neck and a clay pot at the feet of the tree. And, you know, I'm sure everybody listening thinks 13-year-old girls should not be hanging themselves from trees because they spill their water. It wasn't even clean because they were born into a terrible circumstance of extreme poverty. But that's a harsh reality of just what it's like to be one of the 771 million people, what it's like to be a statistic.
Yeah. You actually went and investigated it, didn't you?
Yeah. I lived in that village for a week and got to meet her mother and her friends and her family. And I saw where she got her water and got to walk in her footsteps and saw her grave and talked to the priest who gave her funeral. And then at the end, they took me to this frail tree by a little rocky path. And it was in a moment of time that I really needed to reconnect with the mission in an individual way, in a visceral way. And I remember just coming back determined to work harder, determined to do more, determined to bring more people into this important cause so that kids could have clean drinking water. I mean, Nikki, that's one of the great things. I think, you know, Vic and I shared the blessing for many years. Everybody thinks that what we do is a good idea. Clean water for humans is not political. Yeah. You know, church people think this is a great idea. Yeah. And atheists think this is a great idea.
Yeah.
People of all faiths. And it's really a unifying human issue that, you know, in an increasingly divided world where it seems like we want to fight over everything and every issue these days, you know, one of the few things people can agree on. And, you know, we've really been leaning into that as we try to just grow this movement and invite people to do an inarguably good thing, which is provide people with the most basic need for life, which is water.
Yeah. But I think what people might not, I mean, it can feel like it's all so easy, but actually there's a huge amount of sacrifice involved. Going to that village was not an easy thing to do. Didn't you have to get a donkey and, I mean, and you had to travel a long way to get there.
Yeah, Vic came, Vic's been to probably Ethiopia 15 times or so. I remember on one trip, we set out to make 33 short films because we wanted to, this was around a 33rd birthday campaign. And we wanted to show, hey, look, we didn't just find one isolated village where people were drinking dirty water. This is different in every one of these villages, slightly different, but also real problems. And I think we thought, oh, we'll knock this out in a week or two. And it was weeks of work, you know, trekking 10 hours to some of these villages. And in the end, I think we made 36 different short films of 36 unique villages without clean water and talking to the women and the girls there and learning the different challenges.
I think you cannot do this type of work for a long time if you don't find incredible meaning and joy in it. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the story that I don't know that we tell enough, that we had the best time for 10 years working together, growing a team, being goofballs in the office, making fun of each other, staying up late working, dreaming in conference rooms for days at a time, brainstorming. Like, those are the stories that need to be told,
that's right,
that this work,
not sackcloth and ashes. You know, we weren't walking around saying, woe is us. I get to spend time with dozens of billionaires now. Money doesn't make you happy. I mean, I think we have seen purpose and commitment to your values.
And working with incredible people you love who are like family to you, which we had a community of, I mean, it's the best feeling when you walk into an office of 100 employees and you know everyone is there joined together for the common cause, you know, having lunches together, dreaming together. We had, in a way, I mean, like, we got super lucky because not only did we get to work with people we absolutely adored, loved, and admired, but we got to do something really world changing together with people over years, and that's a rare gift.
I've got you to tell a couple of quite tragic stories in a way, but with very profound meanings. But one of the stories I loved that you tell is of a woman who was able to shower herself for the first time. Just say that. Victoria, is that one of yours? I can't remember who tells that story, but.
Well, it was our first team member. Yes, Becky, who went to Uganda and met Helen, who was this radiant, kind of larger than life woman who was the leader in her community. And she, and I think this was the second time Becky had visited Helen. The first time was before Charity Waters, entered the village. And then the second time Becky went back, She saw Helen again. Helen was celebrating when Becky's car arrived and, you know, waving the branches, which is very typical Ugandan greeting. And, you know, and Becky said, "How are you, Helen? It's nice to see you again." And Helen said, "I'm doing so well, and now I'm beautiful. I feel beautiful." And, you know, Becky didn't get it at first. And she said, "Of course you're beautiful, Helen. You know, you've always been beautiful." And she said, "No, you don't understand. Ever since now having clean water so close to my home, I personally feel beautiful for the first time in my life, because before clean water was near my house, I would only be able to take a small jerry can of water every day because it was so far away. And I'd have to make all these choices. Do I use this water to water my garden? Mm-hmm. Do I wash my kids' school uniforms? Do I make dinner? Do I wash my home?" And in typical Ugandan woman fashion, Ugandan women put themselves last. So she would never have enough water to wash her clothes or wash her body or wash her face. Now with clean water inside her village, she said, "I've for the first time have enough water to do all those other things and wash my own clothes and wash my own face. And I feel beautiful for the first time because I feel clean." And that speaks to this human dignity that we didn't, that's when it clicked for us, like, oh my gosh, we're not just eliminating disease and, you know, healing parasites and making it so that little babies aren't dying of dysentery or diarrhea. We're actually giving people this human dignity because a lot of people we, you know, saw, I mean, they share their water source with their livestock. Like they will literally get water from the same disgusting swamp that their cows drink from. And that's not how a human feels dignity.
Yeah. And you say, I mean, as you've gone on, you've seen all these different aspects to it. I remember somebody saying to me in the early days of Alpha, saying, when you hit a rich seam in a mine, keep digging. You know, it's like you've hit this rich seam in with water and you just have to keep digging. But 2%. So, I mean, you know, this amazing 15 million people that you've helped get clean water, 2%. But you're both of you are entrepreneurs. You think, you know, so what are you thinking now? How are you thinking about the other 98% now?
Well, Nikki, I want to help at least 100 million people through Charity Water.
Okay.
And then as the entire sector grows and there are new water charities that are being started, we're excited about that. More and more people need to get into the conversation, the global conversation about water. So we invite, you know, new players for sure. We're seeing governments step up in many of these communities as the awareness of how important water is. You know, to use your mine analogy, water impacts health. It impacts women and girls. It impacts education. It impacts livelihoods. Yeah. It impacts food security. It's connected to climate. You know, climate is really all about the movement of water on the planet. So there's so much that, you know, water is life, really. I've probably heard that now, and I've been in 70 countries around the world. A version of water is life is told to me in every single place that I've ever visited. So I want us to do a lot more. What's really interesting is we raised $100 million last year for the first time in a single year. And so much of that was powered by people giving monthly, which is kind of funny because, you know, this is the sponsor a child model, maybe, you know, people in the UK, maybe were stopped on the street.
I should say the sponsor a child model is a brilliant model. I wouldn't want any way to be critical of that because it's a brilliant model. And monthly giving to Charity Water is a great model.
So we have a community called The Spring that has been growing. And, you know, in the same way that Spotify or Netflix or Disney Plus are building these communities of people selling music or selling TV, we're selling clean water. And we're selling this idea that 100% of whatever anybody can give, if it's 10 pounds a month, if it's $50 a month, every single penny, pound, you know, euro will go directly to people in need. And that community is really the number one way we're inviting people to join Charity Water now for this next chapter of impact. And we now have Spring members in 149 countries around the world, which is really exciting. We have Spring members in North Korea. We didn't even know that you could donate in North Korea.
Yeah, how amazing.
But apparently people have figured out how to do that. So yeah, I mean, that's, you know, if anybody's listening is moved by the issue or wants to learn more, there's actually a video on thespring.com, which has gotten over 100 million views now, which is kind of a great telling of the Charity Water story. And some of the stuff on the Mercy ship we talked about, you know, you could see the doctors, you could see the ship. Yeah. There's a lot more there, but that's, we're excited. We're trying to help the next 15 million people in a third of the time. We're focused on growth, growing the community, inviting more people into it. And we just want to have a much bigger impact.
Yeah. And Victoria, you're helping lots of other charities to do the same.
Yeah. I'm hoping to indoctrinate more young nonprofits into the Charity Water way, because our vision, our mission is to give every person clean water, but our vision has always been to reinvent charity for our generation and future generations. And that I believe that's kind of the secret other impact we've been able to have, is to inspire so many other charities to think in terms of this creative experience that donors really crave and want. And by being focused on that, they can also see really, really tremendous and significant growth and have more of an impact on the world.
Well, you're both inspiring examples. And God has brought you together. And that's a two is better than one, and a threefold cord will never be broken. So you've got a threefold cord, the two of you, and that your faith. It's a very powerful example. And I hope and pray that lots of people will follow your example. I'm inspired by what you're doing, and I hope many others will be. So thank you so much for giving your time. It's been just really inspiring for me to listen to you and what you're doing, and just so excited just to hear from the last time we met to now just how much has happened and how much progress is made and how many millions of people lives have been changed through what you're doing. So thank you both very, very much indeed.
Thank you, Nikki. Hope to see you soon.
Thank you so much to Scott and Victoria Harrison for joining us on the podcast and sharing their incredible stories and insights with us. Before we go, I'd love to take this chance to invite you to join Nikki Gumbel in person at the Leadership Conference from Alpha, which is happening on May 1st and 2nd next year, live at the Royal Albert Hall in London. Leadership Conference is a two-day event with live worship, inspiring speakers, and the opportunity to connect with other leaders from around the world. It is personally my favorite time of the year. You can find out more and book your place at leadershipconference.org.uk. That's leadershipconference.org.uk. I hope to see you there.